take your Bible and turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Last week we considered the first two verses of this chapter, and this evening the plan is to consider another verse. Hebrews 12, verses 1 to 3. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin that which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary. We'll be looking especially at verse 3 in this passage. Just a reminder, the book of Hebrews was written to an audience that was being persecuted severely in Rome. It is dated sometime between the death of the wicked Emperor Nero and the fall of Jerusalem. So that seems to be the time frame. A lot of animosity. Christians are hunted down, literally. And the author knows that, the circumstances of his audience, and is seeking to write in a manner that will encourage them and strengthen their hands that they might persevere. He tells us, tells them and us, to look to Jesus, verse 2. Then he gives some description there. And then in verse 3, he gives a command again, consider him. And, you know, he's the one who endured from sinners such hostility. Have the command to consider, and then the purpose, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. Notice the this first part, consider him. And the immediate description that he gives, which one? This Jesus, who is he? He's the one who endured from sinners' hostility against himself. He's already used this language of enduring. At the end of verse 1, let us run with endurance the race set before us. Verse 2, Jesus is the one who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. That's exactly what these people needed to hear. They were in danger of not enduring. They were in danger of falling away because of the cultural hostility aimed at them. And they needed to hear this over and over again. So the model set before them is one who did endure, who knew the hostility against him. He's their model. Want to enlarge or expand on this idea of the one that they were to consider and the one for us to consider. The book of Hebrews is one of several books in the Bible that sets out Jesus as prophet, priest, and king. Now that was, those three offices of Jesus were formulated in many of the creeds and confessions of the Protestant Reformation. But they, from where did they get that? Well, they got that from the Bible. That Jesus is set forth as the great prophet, the great priest, the great king. Let's look, considering him who endured, he is and was God's final prophet. In Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, notice this language. Long ago, at many times, in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. Okay? Verse 2. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, the great final prophet, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he created the world. Consider him, the writer says, God's great final prophet. In the past, God spoke in kind of a piecemeal fashion, little bit here, little bit there, some over here, by sending prophets. And some of them had very limited ministries. Some had longer ministries. But still, it was a piecemeal. There would be gaps for years in between the prophets before God would send another one. Now, God sends his final prophet, his own son. You know, just as the repetition of animal sacrifices in the Old Testament showed that they could not, those sacrifices could not ultimately remove guilt, so the repetition of prophets in the Old Testament showed that God's revelation was yet incomplete. He kept adding to it more and more. Another prophet here, more information. Now the great final prophet has come, and God's revealing of himself to his people is complete. God has spoken through his Son. Consider him as God's final prophet. Also, in chapter 1, verse 3, we see this language of God's final priest. Again, Hebrews 1 and verse 3. It says, he is the radiance of the glory of God, exact imprint of his nature. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. Then notice the last sentence of verse 3. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Jesus is not only God's final prophet that the original audience is to consider, but he's also God's perfect priest. Notice the language there in chapter 1, verse 3. After making purification for sins. How did he do that? By offering up of himself a sacrifice. The language here, after making purification for sins. Y'all, we needed to be purified. We needed to be cleansed. Sin makes us dirty before God. Now, we could be very graphic with that. I won't tonight. But sin makes us dirty before God. It stains us. Thus, the language of making purification, this priest of God. And he did so in a way that there would no longer be any more need of blood being shed. It was God, the final sacrifice. Once for all purification. Now the one who did that is seated at the right hand of God. The audience for the book of Hebrews, going through severe persecution. They didn't know when there was going to be another knock on the door. And the Roman soldiers would be outside. And at least their leaders would be crucified publicly. They didn't know. They didn't know when that was coming. But they did know. With the one they are exhorted to consider, his sacrifice is complete. His blood atones for all of my sin. I am clean before God. I am purified from the dirt of my sin. The book of Hebrews in particular expands the priesthood of Christ. More than any other book in the Bible, the book of Hebrews talks about the priestly work of Jesus. And with what time that we have, I would like for us to look at just a couple of passages in Hebrews quickly that speaks to the priesthood of Jesus. The first one is in chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. Again, thinking of the priesthood of Christ, the audience is to consider him. Okay? Chapter 2, verse 17 and 18. Therefore, he, Jesus, had to be made like his brothers in every respect. Why? so that he might become a merciful, faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation, that is a wrath-averting sacrifice, propitiation for the sins of the people. For he himself has suffered when tempted, and he then is able to help those who are being tempted. This is the first time in the book Jesus is called a high priest. Verse 17, chapter 2. And his ministry as God's final high priest was twofold. One, the language is that he was to become that high priest. Okay? He came, he was made like his brothers so that he could become a faithful high priest. But secondly, he came made like his brothers so he could make propitiation, a wrath-bearing, a wrath-absorbing sacrifice. What was the purpose of his humanity? Why did Jesus become a complete human being? To be a faithful high priest, to make that atoning sacrifice. Y'all, he bore the thundering anger of God in himself. The cascading wrath of God fell on him. Our great high priest absorbed it. He took it all. He swallowed it. And there's none left for you. There's none left for me. It's gone. It's gone. He took it as our great high priest. Another expansion here of his priesthood, chapter 4, verse 14 to 16. Notice the language again. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Notice the language there in verse 14. We have a great high priest. We get our language mega, the great mega high priest. That's Jesus. It's like a qualification of excellence. No one surpasses him. No one comes close. He is the ultimate great high priest. Once a year, in the Old Testament, once a year on the Day of Atonement, only the great high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. He went there with blood to make atonement. Once a year. And he was the only one qualified to do that. To do it on the Day of Atonement. Just as earthly or mere human high priest did that, so our great high priest has not only gone into a figurative Holy of Holies, he's passed through the curtains of heaven into the very presence of God to offer himself, to show the stars where he bore our atonement. He is the one who, he says, double negatives, we do not have one who is unable to sympathize. Our high priest is able to sympathize with us, and we may draw near to the throne of grace. The one who lamented in the Garden of Gethsemane in the anticipation of his atoning death for us now hears our prayers of lament, our disappointments, our confusion, our prayers of regret. He hears them. He is able to provide grace to help in time of need. We are told there also in chapter 4, verse 14, since we have such a great high priest, let us hold fast. The idea there is of a steady, patient, determined perseverance. No matter what, we're not going to turn loose at all. God give us grace not to turn loose. Actually, this language is really strong. Let us hold fast. In the Gospels, it's used for when the Romans would arrest someone and put them in chains. I'm glad that's not the figure here. But we're to hold fast. Hold fast to our great high priest. We may draw near. Verse 16, let us draw near with confidence. Again, the only person allowed to do that in the Old Testament was the great high priest, who did it only once a year. You and I are invited all the days of our lives because of our great high priest. We're encouraged to come. One more passage trying to expand this idea of our great high priest is in chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 1 and 2, and then 7 to 10. Chapter 5, verse 1, for every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices. He may deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Then skipping down to verse 7. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Again, thinking of Jesus as our great high priest. He offered up prayers and supplications. He was heard. He learned obedience through what he suffered. He ever lives to make intercession for us. Consider two times in Jesus' ministry on earth. The anguish in the Garden of Gethsemane. Sweat drops of blood. I remember growing up in a Baptist church at home, hearing a doctor speak on that passage one time. And he said, it is a physical phenomenon when people under extreme duress, the blood comes out their pores like sweat. And Jesus, even in this, showing his humanity, as he anticipated the wrath of God falling on him in our place, he sweat drops of blood. The anguish of Gethsemane, think of the agony on the cross where he actually bore the wrath of God. Finally, when it was done, he said, Father, it's finished. It's finished. It's over. Every drop of your wrath and anger has been poured out on me. And I am at the end of my earthly life. And those are the last words he uttered. It is finished. And he died. Jesus is our great high priest. Can you imagine what it meant to the original audience to have Jesus portrayed before them in that manner? If they had such a one at the Father's right hand, who far more than they understood what suffering was like, even unjust suffering. Well, quickly, he's also God's great king. Hebrews 1, at the end of verse 3, after making purification of sins, what did he do? He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. And then also in verse 8 of chapter 1, but of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. All language of kingship. The Son, the Lord Jesus, after he made atonement for sin, purification for sin, sat down at the Father's right hand, enthroned. Unlike the sons of David, who were removed from their father's throne by death, Jesus, after his death, is eternally enthroned. Unlike the continual offerings of the Levitical priests, Jesus sat down having completed once for all his sacrificial work. All right. Y'all, we are to consider him, the writer says. Consider him. And we've only just had a glimpse of the way the writer of the book of Hebrews sets Jesus forth as one who is to be considered prophet, priest, and king. Notice the reason why, back in our text, chapter 12, verse 3, why? Why should we do that? Why were they exhorted to do it? Purpose statement, so that. So that, he says, you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. This is the explicit purpose for considering him. Why? Why do I need to think about Jesus? So that I may not grow faint-hearted, grow weary. Think of how Jesus dealt with his downcast disciples in Luke 24. You know, they thought it all was lost now. They saw him die. They knew he had been buried. And on the road to Emmaus in Luke 24 and verse 27, we're told, you know, Jesus appears as a stranger to them and they're talking, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Then he disappears from their eyes, and we're told they respond in verse 32. They said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us as he opened to us the scriptures? Jesus opened the scriptures to his downcast disciples and spoke to them plainly of the things concerning him. Y'all, that's the same purpose as the writer has in the book of Hebrews. He's setting forth Jesus so that we may not be downcast. In studying for this, I ran across a letter that was sent from churches in France. Now, it's Gaul, back then the Roman province, in the year 177 A.D. As you know, Christianity was still illegal. The Roman legions would hunt you down and give you an excruciating death for all to see. The churches in Lyon, France, had been through this, and they had remained faithful to the end. Their leadership, their members, bore up and bore a faithful testimony, even in the threats and murderous intent of the Roman legions. These churches in Lyon heard of some of their brothers and sisters in Asia Minor, some of the churches there who were beginning to faint and fall away from the faith. They did not think they could bear up under the threats of Rome. And so the churches in Lyon, now we know as Lyon, France, wrote a letter to their brothers and sisters in Asia Minor and the churches there. And we have it in a little booklet form. And it's cost about 50 cents. But it is a wonderful, tender-hearted plea for them to be faithful to Jesus to the end. They list numbers of their members that were members in Lyon, including the famous, perhaps the most famous female martyr, Blandina. And she was publicly humiliated in an arena and remained faithful to the end. And the letter recalls not only her testimony, but many others from those congregations that were martyred. And they plead, not out of guilt, not out of shame, but say, we've been there too. We've been there too, and God gave us grace to be faithful. You hold fast. We'll pray for you, that God will give to you the grace He's given to us. Wonderful story if you run across that. The letter, just a letter from one congregation to others in times of persecution.